Hi, my name is Stephen Parsons, and if you have listened to the podcast series before, if you've listened to any of the other of the podcasts, you know that we have been interviewing people that are related to the medicines of Peru, the Amazon, specifically ayahuasca and San Pedro. Actually, San Pedro is more used in the Andes. But we've been focusing on shamanism as it relates to the practice and the use of these physical medicines, plant medicines. Now, today, we're going to change direction a little bit. I am sitting here with Deborah Annapole. Hello, Deborah.
Hello.
And we're going to have a discussion about shamanism, but coming from a different angle. Deborah is a woman who has been working in the area of sexual shamanism. And I first met Deborah in the mid-90s. Our paths have crossed here and there between then and now. We're going to have a discussion about sexual shamanism, and I don't really have a list of prepared questions, Deborah, so let's just jump in, and I'll just ask you right up front to explain what you mean by the term sexual shamanism.
Okay. And let me say, this is a term I started using in the 90s to describe the work I was doing. I'm not really using this term anymore, but when you started talking about shamanism, it just kind of came up. I started using the term sexual shamanism because the work I was doing combined breath work. At the time, this was similar to what's called holotropic or rebirthing breath. And I was combining that with hands-on physical and energetic sexual stimulation. And people were having very, very deep, profound experiences that resembled shamanic states. So I started using the term sexual shamanism to describe what I was doing. Since then, Ray Stubbs, who is kind of sometimes people call me the grandmother of this or that, but if I'm the grandmother, he's the great-grandfather of sensual massage. He's been doing sensual massage since the early 70s. And in the 90s, he had an accident while he was meditating. He fell out of a chair and since then has become quadriplegic. He had already been studying with the Deer Tribe, so he'd been involved with shamanism. But now we find a very talented sensual massage person who's also very intellectually powerful, and he's in a wheelchair. And so the logical thing for him to do was to develop a body of work that he calls sexual shamanism, which is really about energy mastery. And he's got it all mapped out in great detail. I'm not really that big on systems, but I think for people that want to explore more about sexual shamanism, definitely look at Ray's work. My own work has gone in a little bit of a different direction, although it might still be considered shamanic. I really see that there's a place where the spiritual, the sexual, and the shamanic intersect. And I'm working with a group of people who does trainings in this area, but I'm also very interested in letting people know about the pelvic heart integration work that was developed by Jack Painter. And Jack died a couple of years ago, and I realize it's kind of up to me to share this work with people because he died without documenting it. There's no books. I managed to shoot some video while he was still doing sessions, but the work itself is very complex and sophisticated, and it's, I think I thought of it because what were you calling whole brain shamanism?
Yes, whole brain shamanism is the term that I'm using for these podcasts and a blog site that I have.
Yeah, so the pelvic heart integration is whole brain, or actually whole person healing technology. And it synthesizes elements from Reikian work, from massage body work, Chinese medicine, energy work, psychodrama, gestalt. It really comes from a lot of different directions. And all these pieces are woven together into a work that's similar to what I was describing earlier as the sexual shamanic work I was teaching, but is actually much more sophisticated. And again, people go into deep trance states and have very transformational experiences, similarly to what can happen with the plant medicines.
Okay, now you've mentioned your past work, and you've mentioned the work of two other men.
Yeah, so I worked with Jack for 7 years, and I'm currently the person who is kind of the holder of that body of work called pelvic heart integration. Jack also developed a more generalized body work called postural integration, and there's quite a few people that are trained and practicing postural integration, but the pelvic heart integration, similarly, another parallel with plant medicines, in the United States anyway, in most places, therapies that involve touching genitals are not legal. That's not true in a lot of other countries around the world, but it is true in the United States. So I've taken it on to train people in this work because it's a really amazing healing technology, and it's going to be lost if it's not shared.
Are you forced to train people in other countries and not in the U.S.?
No, I also do training in the United States because, well, without getting into a whole conversation about the details of the laws, the training people in the work is perfectly legal.
Mm-hmm. Okay. This is something which you're doing now, and I'd like to take a closer look at what it's like to experience this sort of work, whether you're in a male body or a female body. What does it feel like? What does it look like? And how it would resemble the kind of states one would go into with ayahuasca, for example.
Okay, well, I think it's easier to describe what it feels like than what it looks like, as it's can look a lot of different ways. But when we were talking earlier, you mentioned something about your guessing that the energy that starts moving in the body through the plant medicines is similar to the energy that's experienced in states of heightened sexual arousal.
Yeah, and let me just jump in and say a little bit more. When one is going through ayahuasca ceremony, it's well known that the active ingredient in ayahuasca is the psychedelic molecule DMT, dimethyltryptamine, which is a naturally occurring substance in the brain. I think it's secreted by the pineal gland. It's also secreted by other organs in the body. It's a naturally occurring organ. It probably has to do with heightened states of awareness, creativity, insight, seeing things in a little bit different way. I don't know. That's a guess, but I'm pretty sure that's something to that. Anyway, so having said that, now back to you. What kind of similarity do you feel there might be between plant medicine-induced states and pelvic heart medicine-induced states?
Well, if it's okay, I'd like to actually back up a little bit. I've been teaching various forms of sacred sexuality for a couple of decades now. People often ask me, well, how did you get into this? They want to know, how did I end up doing this? Really, what I have to tell people is that I discovered tantric sexuality through psychedelic drugs. Because in the late 60s, early 70s, when I was a teenager and exploring these realms, and there were no Tantra workshops like there are now. There really weren't even any books, any Western books. I spontaneously discovered while taking LSD that there were these energy centers in the body that I later learned are called chakras, and I discovered I had the ability to open up this energy and move it from one chakra to another. Of course, I was very curious about this experience. Also, the heightened sensitivity to energy in the body that I first discovered through psychedelics. So honestly, those are my roots in sacred sexuality. At the time, there was no ayahuasca around, so far as I know, but people were taking mushrooms and mescaline and, you know, related substances, peyote. This was my introduction to the subtle energy realms. Now, as I understand it, shamanism, although it often involves plant medicines, doesn't really have to. It really has to do with the ability to work with energy and also to travel between the different worlds, the different states of consciousness. As time has gone on, I've gotten more of a left brain map of what this is all about. And I've also developed my right brain intuitive shamanic, if you want to call it that, skills at working with energy, feeling energy. I'm not someone who sees things so much as I feel things. I'm very kinesthetic. So in the pelvic heart session, well, I first experienced this work in the 90s. A mutual friend had been telling me for a while that I should meet Jack. And Jack was doing an intro evening and he needed a model for the demonstration. So this mutual friend asked if I would be the model. And so I thought, okay, here's my opportunity to meet Jack and experience this work. Sure. So I had my first pelvic heart integration session in the middle of a circle of, I don't know, 20 or 30 people. The sessions normally, you know, there might be a series of 10 sessions gradually leading into the deeper work. But because this was a demonstration, it kind of combined, I don't know, probably half dozen sessions into one. So it was super powerful. The sessions combine breath work, massage. Jack was trained by Ida Rolf to do, you know, deep structural body work. That's not something that I do, but that's part of the original work. It also involves looking into our lineage, looking into the energetic, emotional, and physical imprints that we've gotten from our ancestors. That can usually be simplified down to mommy and daddy, but really if you look back through the generations, you'll see these patterns run back hundreds, maybe thousands of years. And until someone gets conscious and decides to shift them, they're part of what we inherit along with our DNA. So the pelvic heart work uses breath and touch to create a trance state, and then uses the skilled guidance from the facilitator to make people aware of the habitual ways that we learn to cut ourselves off from an energy awareness that I believe would be innate and natural for most people, but we learn to ignore it. And so what this work does is to put us back in touch with
the experiences, thoughts, emotions, and physical and energetic constrictions that we've developed in order to go unconscious. So it brings us back to consciousness, brings us back to conscious awareness, where we can then choose to create new patterns.
So if I heard you right, these patterns of ignoring the energy flows, the current of energy that is natural and innate, this habit of ignoring it or cutting it off is something that we, that it gets passed down from generation to generation. Is that what you were saying?
Yeah, you know, the newborn infant, they may have picked up a little bit of this in the womb, but basically at birth, we're wide open. And very quickly we're taught by our parents, by the culture, to close down, to become less and less alive over time. And of course the sexual energy is the most unwanted, the most uninvited in this culture. And so a lot of the focus of cutting off has to do with sexual issues.
Now, Deborah, so you've been working in this field for a long time. You would be a very good person for me to ask this question. You're the expert, and I'm sure you'll have some insight in this. The question is, you just said sexual energy, for whatever reason, is the most unwanted, but ironically, it's also the most wanted. So we've got this tension going on here. What's up with this?
Okay, well, it's really quite simple. On the one hand, we're talking about our life force energy. We're talking about the urge to reproduce, which has to be very strong so that we will reproduce. And this is what life wants. This is all life forms are created in such a way that their evolutionary purpose, really, is to reproduce. So this is a very powerful, strong energy. At the same time, though, going back, yeah, most people trace this to the beginning of the Christian church, although there's some earlier patriarchal movements that started in this direction. But the theory that a lot of people subscribe to is that people who are sexually free and empowered are more difficult to control. And so it appears that, whether or not you want to buy into that, the culture was created by the early Christian church, which identified the sexual urge as sinful and created guilt and shame around it, and encouraged people to have as little sexual expression as possible. The ideal was to be celibate. And realizing, though, that you couldn't really demand that the whole population be celibate. First of all, most people were incapable of it, and they probably would have rebelled if they'd been told they could have no sex at all. So the next best thing was to have sex only in a monogamous context, blessed by the church, and only for reproduction. So for a couple thousand years now, this is what people have been raised to believe, and this is in conflict with the biological drive to reproduce and have pleasure also.
Well, all right, this is a huge subject. Books could be written and have been written.
Yes, yes. Wilhelm Reich is probably one of the most eloquent German psychiatrists to have discussed all this at length, just before the Second World War. And, of course, he was not a popular person, in part because his theory was that sexual repression leads to an authoritarian personality, to fascism, basically.
Whereas sexual expression or sexual liberation or sexual free flow leads to what?
Well, in Reich's book, The Sexual Revolution, and I believe he was the first person to use that term, he was really talking about something much deeper and much broader than what ended up comprising the sexual revolution. He was talking about the dismantling of the whole personality structure that constricts pleasure, that constricts orgasm. He felt, and he also was talking about the end of the double standard, because at that time there was still very much of a restriction on women's sexuality, much more than men's sexuality. So he was talking about not just a random sexual expression, but actually a deep sexual loving union between men and women. And this got distorted later on into kind of a more recreational, casual, sexual interpretation, which is probably a necessary step for humanity to work its way out of sexual repression, but it's kind of a pendulum swing. So it went from repression is the way it should be to expression is the way it should be. And this deep transformational shift does not occur through superficial sexual expression. It occurs through deep communion, leading to a sense of trust and full body orgasm, that so that every cell in the body actually is affected. This is, again, where I think we start moving into similar territory with the plant medicines and shamanism.
So there are two lines of thought that are present now in my mind. One is around human evolution at a cultural level, and another is this whole body orgasm, cellular excitement being lit up. And the question, is that possible for men as well as women? Let's answer that question first.
Oh, absolutely. Full body orgasm is an experience that's available to everyone and would probably occur naturally, or at least naturally with a little bit of instruction, if we didn't have to contend with generation upon generation of not only sexual repression, but mistrust between men and women.
Well, okay, when I think about mistrust between men and women, I immediately recognize the tension that becomes present.
Yeah, and I'm not talking so much about the mating dance as I am the war between the sexes, which has been going on for at least a couple thousand years, as men and women are raised to have divergent wants and needs and then get into a power struggle where each tries to control the other to get what they want and is not very sympathetic to the wants and needs of the other.
Wow. And so you're saying that this war between the sexes really significantly, you know, cuts into this being illuminated through sexual energy, erotic energy somehow.
Absolutely. I mean, basically what we're talking about is sleeping with the enemy, and how liberating is that going to be? You're going to have your guard up, your defenses up. You're not going to be ready to let go.
Okay, so pelvic heart work, there's two parts, the pelvic and the heart. The heart usually is associated with love, and love is sometimes associated with light. For example, a yellow glow or golden glow of light at the heart level, heart chakra, or the pelvic area. You can play with it in many ways. But I wanted to come to the love thing, the light of love, because light illuminates. We're talking about lighting up the cells. We're talking about being very excited and alive. And I'm not sure what the question is, but what can you say?
Okay, well, pelvic heart integration. Many people hear that and they get really excited because they're aware that either they have a lot of connection with their own heart, they feel very open in their own heart and the upper chakras, but they feel shut down in the pelvis with the sexual energy, or the other way around. Now, the stereotype is that men are sexually alive, sexually desirous, but are afraid of love or shut down in the heart. And that it's the opposite for women, that women want love but are shut down sexually. And like most stereotypes, I mean, there's some truth in that. This is how we have socialized boys and girls for many generations. So even though I think that socialization is starting to change, there's still many people, and it's not strictly along gender lines, who feel disconnected in their heart, in their genitals. Now, Osho, Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, often talked about love and freedom as being a dichotomy, but love and sex, kind of the same thing. And he said these were like two wings of a bird, and you need both wings in order to fly. The truth is that while we might want to associate sex or freedom with men and love or connection with women, we all have masculine and feminine inside of us. And often they're at war with each other. There's a struggle going on internally about whether it's safe to love or whether it's safe to be sexual or whether I can have freedom and commitment at the same time. And this gets projected out onto the other gender. And so it looks like the struggle is between the man outside or the woman outside, but really it's between these two inner aspects that we could call masculine and feminine. And so the pelvic heart work really helps us to take that struggle, to take that war back inside and to find a way to create harmony between the masculine and the feminine inside and to create connection between the heart and the pelvis so that that light and that love can flow freely between the heart and the genitals. It's not limited to one or the other. There's no conflict between them.
I see. Okay, well, thank you. That clears it up a little bit for me. I had a slight misunderstanding. I was visualizing a heart down in the more of the pelvic part of the body.
Well, that is another way to look at it. And in fact, that is another aspect of the pelvic heart work that is that kind of visualization is used at a certain point to help regenerate that connection.
Uh-huh.
And also bringing the sexual energy up to the heart. So we could have the image of the lingam, the phallus, the penis entering the heart. Now, these circuits are often cut off in early childhood because the child, whether it's a boy or a girl, is not supported by mother and father to value the sexual energy and is not supported to be able to have a give and take of this energy with the parents. Now, I'm not talking about sex between parent and child, but I'm talking about an honoring of the life force energy.
Well, how could a parent honor the life force energy in their children in the way that you're talking about?
This often gets cut off because the innocent child, let's say it's a boy, and he's noticed, he's, you know, 2, 3, 4 years old, he's noticed that he has these erotic feelings, as children do. And he wants to send that erotic energy, that masculine energy, out to his mother and have her receive it. Have her appreciate it. Have her recognize it. Often this doesn't happen because she's too sexually inhibited, repressed, cut off herself in order to do this. So she may shame the little boy, she may distance from the little boy. In some way or another, instead of affirming his energy, she negates it. Now, the father also has a role here, which in a healthy circumstance, he would be there cheering the little boy on and encouraging him and supporting him to connect his energy with the mother. Instead, what often happens is the father might be into competition with the boy, or the father is actually kind of scared of mother and communicates his fear to the boy and, you know, is kind of like, oh, stay away from her, she's dangerous. For the little girl, it's similar, but we have the mirror image here. She actually wants the father's masculine energy to be present for her, to fill her up, so that she can feel safe and secure and empowered. The father may not do this because of his sexual inhibition and repression, and so she feels abandoned, she feels unsupported, she doesn't believe that the man can show up and support her, and she becomes very disappointed and angry about this. And again, the mother can support the little girl in feeling safe to take in masculine energy, or she can sabotage this.
This is a whole new world. I have not thought much about this or read anything about this, so I'm wondering if what you're talking about is something that occurs just in very subtle levels, or occurs in at a behavioral level, from time to time, a moment here and a moment there, or I suppose it's different from family to family, but what do you think?
Yeah, both subtle levels and actual experiences. The book has yet to be written. I hope to get to that sometime in the next year or two if I stop traveling so much. But you won't find a lot of this in writing. Now, there is a wonderful book by a man named Michael Sky, who, interestingly enough, was also a breath worker and a fire dancer. But he wrote a book called Sexual Peace, where he very courageously talks about this incident, not with his own daughter, but with the daughter of a friend who's sitting on his lap, and he realizes he's getting an erection and he's very ashamed and embarrassed and doesn't know what to do, but manages to stay present and, you know, not freak out or do anything inappropriate. And he's actually written about this. So here's a very rare instance of a description of behavior that is published. But you know, we're not just talking about specific incidents like this. We're talking about the subtle play of energy really throughout childhood and into adolescence. Particularly, even if that energy current has somehow been preserved in early childhood, often it gets cut off at adolescence.
Sexual shamanism is the general area that we've been talking about. I'm here with Dr. Deborah Annapole, author of Love Without Limits and the Seven
Natural Laws of Love.
All right, thank you.
Yes.
Well, how would people find you? What is your website address?
My website is lovewithoutlimits.com. It's all one, all run together, lovewithoutlimits.com. And I also have a presence on Facebook, Deborah Taj Annapole, PhD, public figure. And I blog for Psychology Today, so it's pretty easy to find me.
I'm sure we could talk on and on, but I think in the interest of time, we better call it good. I really appreciate the opportunity of speaking with you today.
Oh, thank you so much.